He was smiling now, crookedly. And whose fault is that? He leaned back against the seat, his eyes half-lidded with tiredness. I would always have forgiven you, he said. I would have forgiven you if you hadn't apologized. In fact, I wasn't expecting you would. Tessa's influence, I can only guess. I am not here at her request. James, you are all the family I have. Will's voice shook. I would die for you. You know that. I would die without you. If it were not for you, I would be dead 100 times over these past 5 years. I owe you everything. And if you cannot believe I have empathy, perhaps you might at least believe I know honor, honor and debt. Jem looked actually alarmed now. Will, your discomposure is greater than my anger warranted. My temper has cooled. You know I have never had much of one. His tone was soothing, but something in Will could not be soothed. I went to get you that medicine because I cannot bear the thought of you dying or in pain, certainly not when I could have done something to prevent it. And I did it because I was afraid. If Mortmain came to us and said he was the only one who had the drug that would save your life, you must know I would give him whatever he wanted so that I could get it for you. I have failed my family before, James. I would not fail you. Will, Jem rose to his feet. He came across the room to Will and knelt down, looking up into his friend's face. You begin to concern me. Your regret does you admirable credit, but you must know. Will looked down at him. He remembered Jem as he had been when he had just come from Shanghai, and had seemed to be all great dark eyes in a pinched white face. It had not been easy to make him laugh then, but Will had set himself to try. You know what? That I will die, Jem said. His eyes were wide and fever bright. There was a trace of blood still at the corner of his mouth. The shadows under his eyes were nearly blue. Will dug his fingers into Jem's wrist, denting the material of his shirt. Jem did not wince. You swore to stay with me, he said. When we made our oath, as Parabatai, our souls are knit. We are one person, James. We are two people, said Jem. Two people with a covenant between us. Will knew he sounded like a child, but he could not help it. A covenant says that you must not go where I cannot come with you. Until death, Jem replied gently. Those are the words of the oath. Until aught but death part thee and me. Someday, Will, I will go where none can follow me, and I think it will be sooner rather than later. Have you ever asked yourself why I agreed to be your Parabatai? No better offers forthcoming. Will tried for humor, but his voice cracked like glass. I thought you needed me, Jem said. There is a wall you have built about yourself, Will, and I have never asked you why. But no one should shoulder every burden alone. I thought you would let me inside if I became your Parabatai, and then you would have at least someone to lean upon. I did wonder what my death would mean for you. I used to fear it, for your sake. I feared you would be left alone inside that wall. But now, something has changed. I do not know why, but I know that it is true. But what is true? Will's fingers were still digging into Jem's wrist. That the wall is coming down.
Tessa could not get to sleep. She lay unmoving on her back, staring up at the ceiling. There was a crack across the plaster of it that looked sometimes like a cloud and sometimes like a razor, depending on the shift of the candlelight. Dinner had been tense. Apparently Gabriel had told Charlotte that he refused to return and partake in the training anymore, so it was going to be only Gideon working with her and Sophie from now on. Gabriel had refused to say why, but it was clear Charlotte blamed Will. Tessa, seeing how exhausted Charlotte looked at the prospect of more conflict with Benedict, had felt heavy with guilt for having brought Will with her to the training and for having laughed at Gabriel. It did not help that Jem had not been at dinner. She had wanted so badly to speak to him today. After he had avoided her eyes at breakfast and then been ill at dinner, panic had twisted her stomach. Was he horrified by what had happened between them the night before? Or worse, sickened? Maybe in his secret heart of hearts he felt as Will did, that warlocks were beneath him. Or maybe it had nothing to do with what she was. Maybe he was simply repelled by her wantonness. She had welcomed his embraces, not pushed him away. And hadn't Aunt Harriet always said that men were weak where desire was concerned, and that women were the ones who had to exercise restraint? She hadn't exercised much last night. She remembered lying beside Jem, his gentle hands on her. She knew with a painful inner honesty that if things had continued, she would have done whatever he wanted. Even now, thinking about it, her body felt hot and restless. She shifted in bed, punching one of the pillows. If she had destroyed the closeness she shared with Jem by allowing what had happened last night, she would never forgive herself. She was about to bury her face in the pillow when she heard the noise. A soft rapping at the door. She froze. It came again, insistently. Jem! Her hands shaking, she leaped from the bed, ran to the door, and threw it open. On the threshold stood Sophie. She wore her black housemaid's dress, but her white cap had come askew, and her dark curls were tumbling down. Her face was very white, and there was a spot of blood on her collar. She looked horrified and almost sick. "Sophie!" Tessa's voice betrayed her surprise. "Are you all right?" Sophie looked around fearfully. "May I come in, miss?" Tessa nodded and held the door open for her. When they were both safely inside, she bolted it and sat down on the edge of her bed, apprehension like a lead weight in her chest. Sophie remained standing, twisting her hands in front of her. "Sophie, please, what is it?"
"It's Miss Jessamine,"
Sophie burst out.
"What about Jessamine?" "She... it's just to say I've seen her..."
She broke off, looking wretched.
"She's been slipping away in the nights, miss."
"Has she? I saw her last night in the corridor, dressed as a boy and looking quite furtive." Sophie looked relieved. She didn't like Jessamine, Tessa knew that well enough, but she was a well-trained maid, and a well-trained maid did not tattle on her mistress.
"Yes,"
she said eagerly.
"Well, I've been noticing it for days now. Her bed sometimes not slept in at all. Mud on the rugs in the mornings when it weren't there the night before. I would have told Mrs. Branwell, but she's had so dreadful much on her mind, I couldn't bear to."
"So why are you telling me?" Tessa asked. "It sounds as if Jessamine's found herself a suitor." "I can't say I approve of her behavior, but..." She swallowed, thinking of her own behavior the night before. "But neither of us is responsible for it, and perhaps there is some harmless explanation."
"Oh, but miss..."
Sophie plunged her hand into the pocket of her dress and drew it out with a stiff, cream-colored card clamped between her fingers.
"Tonight I found this in the pocket of a new velvet jacket. You know, the one with the écru stripe."
Tessa did not care about the écru stripe. Her eyes were fixed on the card. Slowly she reached out and took it, turning it over in her hand. It was an invitation to a ball. July 20th, 1878. Mr. Benedict Lightwood presents his compliments to Miss Jessamine Lovelace and requests the honor of her company at a masquerade ball given on Tuesday next, the 27th of July, RSVP. The invitation went on to give details of the address and the time the ball would begin, but it was what was written on the back of the invitation that froze Tessa's blood. In a casual hand, as familiar to her as her own, were scrawled the words, "My Jessie, my very heart is bursting at the thought of seeing you tomorrow night at the great affair. However great it may be, I shall have eyes for nothing and no one but you. Do wear the white dress, darling, as you know how I like it, in gloss of satin and glimmer of pearls. As the poet said, yours always, N.G.
"Nate," Tessa said numbly, staring down at the letter. "Nate wrote this, and quoted Tennyson." Sophie drew her breath in sharply.
"I feared, but I thought it couldn't be, not after all he did."
"I know my brother's handwriting,"
Tessa's voice was grim. He's planning to meet her tonight at this secret ball.
Sophie, where is Jessamine? I must speak to her this instant.
Sophie's hands began to twist more rapidly.
See, that's the thing, miss.
Oh, God, has she gone already? We'll have to get Charlotte. I don't see another way.
She hasn't gone. She's in a room.
Sophie interrupted. So she doesn't know you found this? Tessa flapped the card. Sophie swallowed visibly.
She found me with it in my hand, miss. I tried to hide it, but she already seen it. She had such a menacing look on her face when she came reaching for it, I couldn't help myself. All the training sessions I've done with Master Gideon, they just took over and, well...
Well, what, Sophie?
I hit her on the head with a mirror,
Sophie said hopelessly.
One of those silver-backed ones, so it was quite heavy. She went down just like a stone, miss. So I tied her to the bed and I came looking for you.
Let me see if I have this quite correct, said Tessa after a pause. Jessamine found you with the invitation in your hand, so you struck her over the head with a mirror and tied her to her bed?
Sophie nodded.
Good Lord, said Tessa. Sophie, we're going to need to fetch someone. This ball cannot remain a secret, and Jessamine...
Not Mrs. Bramwell,
Sophie moaned.
She'll sack me. She'll have to.
Jem.
No!
Sophie's hand flew to her collar where the spot of blood was. Jessamine's blood, Tessa realized with a jolt.
I couldn't bear if he thought I could do such a thing. He's so gentle. Please, don't make me tell him, miss.
Of course, Tessa thought. Sophie loved Jem. In all the mess of the past few days, she had nearly forgotten. A wave of shame swamped her as she thought of the night before. She fought it back and said determinedly,
There is only one person, then, Sophie, whom we can go to. You do understand that.
Master Will,
said Sophie with loathing and sighed.
Oh, very well, miss. I suppose I don't care what he thinks of me.
Tessa rose and reached for her dressing gown and wrapped it around herself. Look up on the bright side, Sophie. At least Will won't be shocked. I doubt Jessamine's the first unconscious female he's ever dealt with, or that she'll be the last, either. Tessa had been wrong about at least one thing. Will was shocked.
Sophie did this?
He said, not for the first time. They were standing at the foot of Jessamine's bed. She lay flung upon it, her chest rising and falling slowly like the famous Sleeping Beauty waxwork of Madame du Barry. Her fair hair was scattered on the pillow, and a large bloody welt ran across her forehead. Each of her wrists was tied to a post of the bed.
Our Sophie?
Tessa glanced over at Sophie, who was sitting in a chair by the door. Her head was down, and she was staring at her hands. She studiously avoided looking at Tessa or Will.
Yes, Tessa said, and do stop repeating it. I think I may be in love with you, Sophie, said Will. Marriage could be on the cards.
Sophie whimpered.
Stop it, Tessa hissed. I think you're frightening the poor girl more than she's already frightened.
What's to be frightened of, Jessamine? It looks like Sophie won that little altercation easily.
Will was having trouble repressing a grin.
Sophie, my dear, there is nothing to worry about. Many's the time I have wanted to hit Jessamine over the head myself. No one could blame you.
She's afraid Charlotte will sack her, said Tessa.
For hitting Jessamine?
Will relented.
Tess, if this invitation is what it looks like, and Jessamine is truly meeting your brother in secret, she may have betrayed us all. Not to mention, what is Benedict Lightwood doing, throwing parties that none of us know about? Parties to which Nate is invited? What Sophie did was heroic. Charlotte would thank her.
At that, Sophie lifted her head.
So you think so?
I know it, said Will.
For a moment, he and Sophie looked at each other steadily across the room. Sophie looked away first, but if Tessa was not mistaken, there had been, for the first time, no dislike in her eyes when she'd gazed at Will. From his belt, Will drew his steely. He sat down on the bed beside Jessamine and gently brushed aside her hair. Tessa bit her lip, restraining the impulse to ask him what he was doing. He laid his steely against Jessamine's throat and quickly sketched two runes.
"Inerazi," he said, without Tessa's having to ask. "That is, a healing rune and a sleep now rune. This should keep her quiet at least until morning. Your skill with a hand mirror is to be admired, Sophie, but your knot-making could be improved." Sophie muttered something under her breath in response. The suspension of her dislike of Will appeared to be over.
"The question," said Will, "is what to do now."
"We must tell Charlotte."
"No," Will said firmly. "We must not."
Tessa looked at him in astonishment.
"Why not?"
"Two reasons," said Will.
"First, she would be duty-bound to tell the Clave, and if Benedict Lightwood is hosting this ball, I would make a fair guess that some of his followers would be there, but they might not all be. If the Clave is warned, they may be able to get word to him before anyone can arrive to observe what is truly going on. Second, the ball began an hour ago. We do not know when Nate will arrive, seeking Jessamine, and if he does not see her, he may well depart. He is the best connection to Mortmain we have. We do not have any time to lose or waste, and waking Charlotte to tell her of this will do both."
"Jem, then?"
Something flickered in Will's eyes.
"No, not tonight. Jem is not well enough, but he will say he is. After last night, I owe it to him to leave him out of this."
Tessa looked at him hard.
"Then what do you propose to do?"
Will's mouth quirked up at both corners.
"Miss Gray," he said, "would you be amenable to attending a ball with me?"
"Do you remember the last party we went to?" Tessa inquired.
Will's smile remained. He had that look of heightened intensity that he wore when he was strategizing a plan.
"Don't tell me that you weren't thinking the same thing I was, Tessa."
Tessa sighed.
"Yes," she said.
"I shall change into Jessamine and go in her place. It is the only plan that makes sense." She turned to Sophie. "Do you know the dress Nate spoke of, a white dress of Jessamine's?" Sophie nodded.
"Get it brushed and ready to be worn," said Tessa.
"You will have to do my hair as well, Sophie. Are you calm enough?"
"Yes, miss."
Sophie got to her feet and scurried across the room to the wardrobe, which she threw open. Will was still looking at Tessa. His smile widened.
Tessa lowered her voice.
"Will, has it crossed your mind that Mortmain might be there?" The smile vanished from Will's face.
"You will go nowhere near him if he is."
"You cannot tell me what to do."
Will frowned. He was not reacting at all in the way Tessa felt he should. When Capitola, in the Hidden Hand, dressed up as a boy and took on the marauding Black Donald to prove her bravery, no one snapped at her.
"Your power is impressive, Tessa, but you are in no position to capture a powerful adult magic user like Mortmain. You will leave that to me," he said.
She scowled at him. "And how do you plan not to be recognized at this ball? Benedict knows your face, as do—" Will seized the invitation out of her hand and waved it at her.
"It's a masked ball."
"And I suppose you just happen to have a mask?"
"As a matter of fact, I do," said Will. "Our last Christmas party was themed along the lines of the Venetian Carnival," he smirked. "Tell her, Sophie."
Sophie, who was busy with what looked like a concoction of spiderwebs and moonbeams on the brushing tray, sighed.
"It's true, miss. And you let him deal with Mortmain, you hear? It's too dangerous otherwise, and you'll be all the way in Chiswick."
Will looked at Tessa with triumph.
"If even Sophie agrees with me, you can't very well say no."
"I could," Tessa said mutinously, "but I won't."
"Very well, but you must stay out of Nate's way while I speak with him. He isn't an idiot. If he sees us together, he's quite capable of putting two and two together. I get no sense from his note that he expects Jessamine to be accompanied."
"I get no sense from his note at all," said Will, bounding to his feet.
"Except that he can quote Tennyson's lesser poetry. Sophie, how quickly can you have Tessa ready?"
"Half an hour,"
said Sophie, not looking up from the dress.
Meet me in the courtyard in half an hour, then, said Will. I'll wake Cyril. And be prepared to swoon at my finery. The night was a cool one, and Tessa shivered as she passed through the doors of the Institute and stood at the head of the steps outside. This was where she had sat, she thought, that night she and Jem had walked to Blackfriars Bridge together, the night the clockwork creatures had attacked them. It was a clearer night tonight, despite the day of rain. The moon chased stray wisps of cloud across an otherwise unmarked black sky. The carriage was there at the foot of the steps, Will waiting in front of it. He glanced up as the doors of the Institute closed behind her. For a moment they simply stood and looked at each other. Tessa knew what he was seeing. She had seen it herself in the mirror in Jessamine's room. She was Jessamine, down to the last inch, clothed in a delicate ivory silk dress. It was low-cut, revealing a great deal of Jessamine's white bosom, with a silk ribbon at the collar to emphasize the shape of her throat. The sleeves were short, leaving her arms vulnerable to the night air. Even if the neckline hadn't been so low, Tessa would have felt naked without her angel, but she couldn't wear it. Nate would have been sure to notice it. The skirt, with a waterfall train, belled up behind her from a laced, slender waist. Her hair was dressed high, with a length of pearls held in place by pearl pins, and she wore a gold domino half-mask that set off Jessamine's pale, fair hair to perfection. "I look so delicate," she had thought with detachment, staring at the mirror's silvered surface as Sophie had fussed about her. "Like a fairy princess." It was easy to think such thoughts when the reflection was not truly your own. But Will? Will. He had said she should be ready to swoon at his finery, and she had rolled her eyes, but in his black and white evening dress, he looked more beautiful than she had imagined. The stark and simple colors brought out the angular perfection of his features. His dark hair tumbled over a black half-mask that emphasized the blueness of the eyes behind it. She felt her heart contract and hated herself instantly for it. She looked away from him at Cyril in the driver's seat of the carriage. His eyes narrowed in confusion as he saw her. He looked from her to Will and back again and shrugged. Tessa wondered what on earth Will had told him that they were doing to explain the fact that he was taking Jessamine to Chiswick in the middle of the night. It must have been quite a story. "Ah," was all Will said as she descended the steps and drew her wrap around herself. She hoped he would put down to the cold the involuntary shiver that went over her as he took her hand. "I see now why your brother quoted that execrable poetry. You are meant to be Maud, aren't you? Queen Rose of the Rosebud Garden of Girls." "You know," Tessa said as he helped her up into the carriage, "I don't care for that poem either." He swung himself up after her and slammed the carriage door shut. "Jessamine adores it." The carriage began to rumble across the cobblestones and through the open doors of the gate. Tessa found that her heart was beating very fast. Fear of being caught by Charlotte and Henry, she told herself. Nothing to do with being alone with Will in the carriage. "I am not Jessamine." He looked at her levelly. There was something in his eyes, a sort of quizzical admiration. She wondered if it was simply admiration of Jessamine's looks. "No," he said. "No, even though you are the perfect picture of Jessamine, I can see Tessa through it somehow. As if I were to scrape away a layer of paint, there would be my Tessa underneath." "I am not your Tessa, either." The light sparkling in his eyes dimmed. "Fair enough," he said. "I suppose you are not. What is it like being Jessamine, then? Can you sense her thoughts? Read what she feels?" Tessa swallowed and touched the velvet curtain of the carriage with a gloved hand. Outside she could see the gaslights going by in a yellow blur. Two children were slumped in a doorway, leaning against each other asleep. Temple Bar flew by overhead. She said, "I tried. Upstairs in her bedroom. But there's something wrong. I couldn't feel anything from her."
"Well, I suppose it's hard to meddle in someone's brains if they've got no brains to start with,"
Tessa made a face. Be flippant about it if you like, but there is something wrong with Jessamine. Trying to touch her mind is like trying to touch a nest of snakes or a poisonous cloud. I can feel a little of her emotions, a great deal of rage and longing and bitterness, but I cannot pick out the individual thoughts among them. It is like trying to hold water.
That's curious. Have you ever come across anything like it before?
Tessa shook her head.
It concerns me. I am afraid Nate will expect me to know something, and I will not know it or have the right answer. Will leaned forward. On wet days, which was nearly every day, his normally straight dark hair would begin to curl. There was something about the vulnerable curling of his damp hair against his temples that made her heart ache.
You are a good actress, and you know your brother, he said. I have every confidence in you.
She looked at him in surprise. You do?
And, he went on without answering her question, in the event that something goes awry, I will be there. Even if you don't see me, Tess, I'll be there. Remember that.
All right. She cocked her head to the side. Will?
Yes.
There was a third reason you didn't want to wake up Charlotte and tell her what we were doing, wasn't there?
He narrowed his blue eyes at her. And what's that?
Because you do not know yet if this is simply a foolish flirtation on Jessamine's part, or something deeper and darker. A true connection to my brother and to Mortmain. And you know that if it is the second, it will break Charlotte's heart.
A muscle jumped at the corner of his mouth. And what do I care if it does? If she is foolish enough to attach herself to Jessamine.
You care, said Tessa. You are no inhuman block of ice, Will. I have seen you with Jem. I saw you when you looked at Cecily, and you had another sister, didn't you?
He looked at her sharply. What makes you think I had? I have more than one sister.
Jem said he thought your sister was dead, she said.
And you said, my sister is dead, but Cecily is clearly very much alive, which made me think you had a sister who had died. One that wasn't Cecily. Will let out a long, slow breath. You're clever.
But am I clever and right, or clever and wrong?
Will looked as if he were glad for the mask that hid his expression. Ella, he said, 2 years older than I. And Cecily, 3 years younger. My sisters.
And Ella? Will looked away, but not before she saw the pain in his eyes.
So Ella was dead.
What was she like?
Tessa asked, remembering how grateful she had been when Jem had asked that of her about Nate.
Ella, and Cecily, what kind of girl is she?
Ella was protective, said Will, like a mother. She would have done anything for me. And Cecily was a little mad creature. She was only 9 when I left. Can't say if she's still the same, but she was like Kathy in Wuthering Heights. She was afraid of nothing and demanded everything. She could fight like a devil and swear like a Billingsgate fishwife.
There was amusement in his voice, and admiration and love. She had never heard him talk about anyone that way, except perhaps Jem. If I might ask, she began.
Will sighed. You know you'll ask whether I say it's all right or not.
You have a younger sister of your own, she said. So what exactly did you do to Gabriel's sister to make him hate you so?
He straightened. Are you serious?
Yes, she said. I am forced to spend a great deal of time with the Lightwoods, and Gabriel clearly despises you. And you did break his arm. It would ease my mind if I knew why.
Shaking his head, Will raked his fingers through his hair. Dear God, he said. Their sister, her name is Tatiana, by the way. She was named after her mother's dear friend, who was Russian. Was 12 years old, I think.
12?
Tessa was horrified. Will exhaled. I see you have already decided for yourself what happened, he said. Would it ease your mind further to know that I myself was 12? Tatiana, she fancied herself in love with me. in that way that little girls do. She would follow me around and giggle and duck behind pillars to stare at me. One does silly things when one is 12. It was the first Christmas party at the Institute that I attended, he said. The Lightwoods were there in all their finery, Tatiana in silver hair ribbons. She had a little book she carried around with her everywhere. She must have dropped it that night. I found it shoved down the back of one of the sheds. It was her diary, filled with poems about me, the color of my eyes, the wedding we would have. She had written, Tatiana Herondale, all over it. That sounds rather adorable. I had been in the drawing room, but I came back into the ballroom with the diary. Elise Penhallow had just finished playing the spinet. I got up beside her and commenced reading from Tatiana's diary.
Oh, Will, you didn't.
I did, he said. She had rhymed William with million, as in, you will never know, sweet William, how many are the million ways in which I love you. It had to be stopped.
What happened?
Oh, Tatiana ran out of the room in tears, and Gabriel leaped onto the stage and attempted to strangle me. Gideon simply stood there with his arms crossed. You'll notice that's all he ever does. I suppose Gabriel didn't succeed, said Tessa. In strangling you, I mean. Not before I broke his arm, said Will with relish. So, there you are. That's why he hates me. I humiliated his sister in public, and what he won't mention is that I humiliated him, too. He thought he could best me easily. I'd had little formal training, and I'd heard him call me very nearly a mundane behind my back. Instead, I beat him hollow. Snapped his arm, in fact. It was certainly a more pleasant sound than Elise banging away on a spinet. Tessa rubbed her gloved hands together to warm them and sighed. She wasn't sure what to think. It was hardly the story of seduction and betrayal she had expected, but neither did it show Will in an admirable light. Sophie says she's married now, she said. Tatiana. She's just getting back from traveling the continent with her new husband. I am sure she is as dull and stupid now as she was then. Will sounded as if he might fall asleep. He thumbed the curtain close, and they were in darkness. Tessa could hear his breath, feel the warmth of him sitting across from her. She could see why a proper young lady would never ride in a carriage with a gentleman not related to her. There was something oddly intimate about it. Of course, she had broken the rules for proper young ladies what felt like long ago now. Will, she said again. The lady has another question. I can hear it in her tone. Well, you never have done asking questions, Tess. Not until I get all the answers I want, she said. Will, if warlocks are made by having one demon parent and one human parent, what happens if one of those parents is a shadow hunter? A shadow hunter would never allow that to happen, said Will flatly. But in the Codex, it says that most warlocks are the result of a violation, Tessa said, her voice hitching on the ugly word. Or shape-changer demons taking on the form of a loved one and completing the seduction by a trick. Jem told me Shadowhunter blood is always dominant. The Codex says the offspring of Shadowhunters and werewolves, or fairies, are always Shadowhunters, so could not the angel blood in a Shadowhunter cancel out that which was demonic and produce... What it produces is nothing. Will tugged at the window curtain. The child would be born dead. They always are. Stillborn, I mean. The offspring of a demon and a Shadowhunter parent is death. In the little light he looked at her. Why do you want to know these things? I want to know who I am, she said. I believe I am some combination that has not been seen before. Part fairy or part... Have you ever thought of transforming yourself into one of your parents? Will asked. Your mother or father? It would give you access to their memories, wouldn't it? I have thought of it. Of course I have, but I have nothing of my father's or mother's. Everything that was packed in my trunks for the voyage here was discarded by the Dark Sisters. What about your angel necklace? Will asked. Wasn't that your mother's?
Tessa shook her head. I tried. I could reach nothing of her in it. It has been mine so long, I think, that what made it hers has evaporated like water.
Will's eyes gleamed in the shadows. Perhaps you're a clockwork girl. Perhaps Mortmain's warlock father built you, and now Mortmain seeks the secret of how to create such a perfect facsimile of life when all he can build are hideous monstrosities. Perhaps all that beats beneath your chest is a heart made of metal.
Tessa drew in a breath, feeling momentarily dizzy. His soft voice was so convincing, and yet...
No, she said sharply. You forget, I remember my childhood. Mechanical creatures do not change or grow, nor would that explain my ability.
I know, said Will with a grin that flashed white in the darkness. I only wanted to see if I could convince you.
Tessa looked at him steadily. I am not the one who has no heart. It was too dark in the carriage for her to tell, but she sensed that he flushed darkly. Before he could say anything in response, the wheels came to a jerking halt. They had arrived.
Chapter 12. Masquerade. So now I have sworn to bury all this dead body of hate. I feel so free and so clear by the loss of that dead weight, that I should grow light-headed, I fear, fantastically merry. But that her brother comes like a blight on my fresh hope to the hall tonight. Alfred Lord Tennyson. Maud.
Cyril had paused the carriage outside the gates of the property, under the shade of a leafy oak tree. The Lightwoods country house in Chiswick, just outside London proper, was massive, built in the Palladian style, with soaring pillars and multiple staircases. The radiance of the moon made everything pearlescent, like the inside of an oyster shell. The stone of the house seemed to gleam silver, while the gate that ran around the property had the sheen of black oil. None of the lights in the house seemed to be illuminated. The place was as dark as pitch and grave silent, the vast ground stretching all around it down to the edge of a meander in the Thames River, unlit and deserted. Tessa began to wonder if they had made a mistake in coming here. As Will left the carriage, helping her down after him, his head turned, his fine mouth hardening.
Do you smell that? Demonic witchcraft. Its stink is on the air.
Tessa made a face. She could smell nothing unusual. In fact, this far out of the city center, the air smelled cleaner than it had near the Institute. She could smell wet leaves and dirt. She looked over at Will, his face raised to the moonlight, and wondered what weapons lay concealed under his closely fitted frock coat. His hands were sheathed in white gloves, his starched shirt front immaculate. With the mask, he could have been an illustration of a handsome highwayman in a penny dreadful.
Tessa bit her lip. Are you certain? The house looks deadly quiet, as if no one were home. Could we be wrong?
He shook his head.
There is powerful magic at work here. Something stronger than a glamour. A true ward. Someone very much does not want us to know what is happening here tonight.
He glanced down at the invitation in her hand, shrugged, and went up to the gate. There was a bell there, and he rang it, the noise jingling Tessa's already stretched nerves. She glared at him. He grinned, and melted away into the shadows, just as the gate before her opened. A hooded figure stood before her. Her first thought was of the Silent Brothers, but their robes were the color of parchment, and the figure that stood before her was robed in the color of black smoke. The hood hid its face completely. Wordlessly, she held out her invitation. The hand that took it from her was gloved. For a moment, the hidden face regarded the invitation. Tessa could not help but fidget. In any ordinary circumstances, a young lady attending a ball alone would be so improper as to be scandalous. But this was no ordinary circumstance. At last, a voice issued from beneath the hood.
Welcome, Miss Lovelace. It was a gritty voice,
a voice like skin being scraped over a rough, tearing surface. Tessa's spine prickled, and she was glad she could not see beneath the hood. The figure returned the invitation to her and stepped back, gesturing her inside. She followed, forcing herself not to look around to see if Will was following. She was led around the side of the house, down a narrow garden path. The gardens extended for a good distance out around the house, silvery green in the moonlight. There was a circular black ornamental pond, with a white marble bench beside it and low hedges, carefully clipped, running alongside neat paths. The path she was on ended at a tall and narrow entrance set into the house's side. A strange symbol was carved into the door. It seemed to shift and change as Tessa looked at it, making her eyes hurt. She looked away as her hooded companion opened the door and gestured for her to go inside. She entered the house, and the door slammed behind her. She turned just as it shut, catching a glimpse, she thought, of the face beneath the hood. She thought she had seen something very like a cluster of red eyes in the center of a dark oval, like the eyes of a spider. She caught her breath as the door clicked shut, and she was plunged into darkness. As she reached blindly for the handle of the door, light sprang up all around her. She was standing at the foot of a long, narrow staircase that led upward. Torches burning with a greenish flame, not witch light, ran up the sides of the stairs. At the top of the stairs was a door. Another symbol was painted on this one. Tessa felt her mouth go even drier. It was the Ouroboros, the double serpent, the symbol of the Pandemonium Club. For a moment she felt frozen with fear. The symbol brought bleak memories rushing back. The dark house, the sisters, torturing her, trying to force her to change. Nate's betrayal. She thought of Jane Eyre, bravely facing down the angry Mr. Rochester. Catherine Earnshaw, who, when mauled by a savage dog, did not yell out, no, she would have scorned to do it. And lastly, she thought of Boadicea, who Will had told her was braver than any man. It's just a ball, Tessa, she told herself, and reached for the knob. Just a party. She had never been to a ball before, of course. She knew only a little of what to expect, and all of that was from books. In Jane Austen's books, the characters were constantly waiting for there to be a ball, or arranging a ball, and often an entire village seemed to be involved in the planning and location of the ball. Whereas in other books, such as Vanity Fair, they were grand backdrops against which scheming and plotting occurred. She knew that there would be a dressing room for the ladies, where she could leave her shawl, and one for the men, where they could safely dispose of hats, overcoats, and walking sticks. There ought to be a dance card for her, where the names of the men who had asked her to dance could be marked down. It was rude to dance more than a few dances in a row with the same gentleman. There should be a grand, beautifully decorated ballroom and a smaller refreshment room, where there would be iced drinks and sandwiches and biscuits and tipsy cake. But it was not quite like that. As the door closed behind her, Tessa found no servants hurrying to greet her, to guide her to the ladies' dressing room and offer to take her shawl or assist her with a missing button. Instead, a wash of noise and music and light struck her like a wave. She stood at the entrance to a room, so grand, it was hard to believe that it fit somehow into the Lightwoods' house. A great crystal chandelier hung from the ceiling. It was only after looking at it for several moments that Tessa realized it was shaped like a spider, with eight dangling legs, each of which held a collection of massive tapers. The walls, what she could see of them, were a very dark blue, and running all along the side that faced the river were French windows, some propped open to catch the breeze, for the room, despite the cool weather outside, was stifling. Beyond the windows were curved stone balconies looking out over a view of the city. The walls were largely obscured by great swathes of shimmering fabric, loops and whorls of it hanging over the windows and moving in the faint breeze. The fabric was figured with all manner of patterns, woven in gold. the same shimmering, shifting patterns that had hurt Tessa's eyes downstairs. The room was crowded with people. Well, not quite people, exactly. The majority looked human enough. She caught sight also of the dead, white faces of vampires and a few of the violet and red-hued ifrits, all dressed in the height of fashion. Most, though not all, of the attendees wore masks, elaborate contraptions of gold and black, beaked plague doctor masks with tiny spectacles, red devil masks complete with horns. Some were barefaced, though, including a group of women whose hair was muted tints of lavender, green, and violet. Tessa did not think they were dyes, either, and they wore their hair loose, like nymphs in paintings. Their clothes were scandalously loose, as well. They were clearly uncorseted, dressed in flowing fabrics of velvet, tulle, and satin. In and among the human guests darted figures of all sizes and shapes. There was a man, far too tall and thin to be a man, dressed in topcoat and tails, looming over a young woman in a green cloak, whose red hair shone like a copper penny. Creatures that looked like great dogs roamed among the guests, their yellow eyes wide and watchful. They had rows of spikes along their backs, like drawings of exotic animals she had seen in books. A dozen or so little goblin creatures screeched and chattered to one another in an incomprehensible language. They appeared to be fighting over some foodstuff, what looked like a torn-apart frog. Tessa swallowed down bile and turned, and saw them where she had not before. Her mind had perhaps dismissed them as decorations, suits of armor, but they were not. Automatons lined the walls, silent and motionless. They were human in shape, like the coachman who had belonged to the Dark Sisters, and wore the livery of the Lightwood household, each with a patterned Ouroboros above its left breast. Their faces were blank and featureless, like children's sketches that had not been filled in. Someone caught her by the shoulders. Her heart gave a great leap of fear. She had been discovered. As every muscle in her body tightened, a light, familiar voice said, "I thought you'd never get here, Jessie dear." She turned and looked up into the face of her brother. The last time Tessa had seen Nate, he had been bruised and bloodied, snarling at her in a corridor of the Institute, a knife in his hand. He had been a terrible mixture of frightening and pathetic and horrifying all at once. This Nate was quite different. He smiled down at her. Jessamine was so much shorter than she was. It was odd not to reach to her brother's chin, but rather to his chest, with vivid blue eyes. His fair hair was brushed and clean, his skin unmarked by bruises. He wore an elegant dress coat and a black shirt front that set off his fair good looks. His gloves were spotlessly white. This was Nate as he had always dreamed of being. Rich-looking, elegant, and sophisticated, a sense of contentment oozed from him. Less contentment, Tessa had to admit, than self-satisfaction. He looked like Church did after he had killed a mouse. Nate chuckled. "What is it, Jess? You look as if you've seen a ghost." "I have. The ghost of the brother I once cared about." Tessa reached for Jessamine, for the imprint of Jessamine in her mind. Again it felt as if she were passing her hands through poisonous water, unable to grasp anything solid.
A sudden fear came over me that you would not be here," she said.
This time his laugh was tender. "And miss a chance to see you? Don't be a foolish girl." He glanced around, smiling. Lightwood should lay himself out to impress the Magister more often. He held out a hand to her. "Would you do me the honor of favoring me with a dance, Jessie?"
Jessie, not Miss Lovelace.
Any doubt Tessa might have had that their attachment was serious indeed was gone. She forced her lips into a smile.
"Of course."
The orchestra, a collection of small, purple-skinned men dressed in silvery netting, was playing a waltz. Nate took her hand and drew her out onto the floor.
Thank God, Tessa thought. Thank God she'd had years of her brother swinging her around the living room of their tiny flat in New York. She knew exactly how he danced, how to fit her movements to his, even in this smaller, unfamiliar body. Of course, he had never looked down at her like this. Tenderly, with lips slightly parted. Dear God, what if he kissed her? She had not thought of the possibility. She would be sick all over his shoes if he did.
Oh, God,
she prayed.
Let him not try.
She spoke rapidly.
I had dreadful trouble sneaking out of the Institute tonight, she said. That little wretch Sophie nearly found the invitation.
Nate's grip tightened on her. But she didn't, did she? There was a warning in his voice. Tessa sensed she was already close to a serious gaffe. She tried a quick glance around the room.
Oh, where was Will? What had he said? Even if you don't see me, I'll be there. But she had never felt so much on her own.
With a deep breath, she tossed her head in her best imitation of Jessamine.
Do you take me for a fool? Of course not. I wrapped her skinny wrist with my mirror and she dropped it immediately. Besides, she probably can't even read.
Truly, said Nate, relaxing visibly. They could have found you a lady's maid who more befits a lady. One who speaks French, can sew.
Sophie can sew,
Tessa said, automatically, and could have slapped herself.
Passably,
she amended, and batted her eyelashes up at Nate.
And how have you been keeping since the last time we saw each other?
Not that I have the slightest idea when that might have been. Very well. The Magister continues to favor me.
He is wise,
Tessa breathed.
He recognizes an invaluable treasure when he sees one.
Nate touched her face lightly with a gloved hand. Tessa willed herself not to stiffen. All down to you, my darling, my veritable little mine of information. He moved closer to her. I see you wore the dress I asked you to, he whispered. Ever since you described how you wore it to your last Christmas ball, I've yearned to see you in it, and may I say that you dazzle the eyes. Tessa's stomach felt as if it were trying to force its way up into her throat. Her eyes darted around the room again. With a lurch of recognition, she saw Gideon Lightwood cutting a fine figure in his evening dress, though he stood stiffly against one of the walls as if plastered there. Only his eyes moved around the room. Gabriel was wandering to and fro, a glass of what looked like lemonade in his hand, his eyes glowing with curiosity. She saw him go up to one of the girls with long lavender hair and begin a conversation. So much for any hope that the boys did not know what their father was up to, she thought, glancing away from Gabriel in irritation. And then she saw Will. He was leaning against the wall opposite her, between two empty chairs. Despite his mask, she felt as if she could see directly into his eyes, as if he were standing close enough to touch. She would have half expected him to look amused at her predicament, but he did not. He looked tense and furious, and... God, I'm jealous of every other man who looks at you, Nate said. You should be looked at only by me. Good Lord, Tessa thought. Did this line of talk really work on most women? If her brother had come to her with the aim of asking her advice on these pearls, she would have told him straight off that he sounded like an idiot. Though perhaps she only thought he sounded like an idiot because he was her brother. And despicable. Information, she thought. I must get information and then get away from him before I really am sick. She looked for Will again, but he was gone, as if he had never been there. Still, she believed him now that he was somewhere, watching her, even if she couldn't see him. She plucked up her nerve and said,
Really, Nate? Sometimes I fear you value me only for the information I can give you.
For a moment he stopped, and was stock still, almost jerking her out of the dance. Jesse, how can you even think such a thing? You know how I adore you. He looked at her reproachfully as they began to move to the music again. It is true that your connection to the Nephilim of the Institute has been invaluable,
Without you, we would never have known they were going to York, for instance. But I thought you knew that you were helping me because we are working toward a future together. When I have become the Magister's right hand, darling, think how I will be able to provide for you. Tessa laughed nervously.
You're right, Nate. It's only that I get frightened sometimes. What if Charlotte were to find out I was spying for you? What would they do to me?
Nate swung her around easily. Oh, nothing, darling. You've said it yourself. They're cowards. He looked past her and raised an eyebrow. Benedict, up to his old tricks, he said. Rather disgusting. Tessa looked around and saw Benedict Lightwood leaning back on a scarlet velvet sofa near the orchestra. He was coatless, a glass of red wine in one hand, his eyes half-lidded. Sprawled across his chest, Tessa saw, to her shock, was a woman. Or at least it had the form of a woman. Long black hair worn loose, a low-cut black velvet gown, and the heads of little serpents poking out from her eyes, hissing. As Tessa watched, one of them extended a long, forked tongue and licked the side of Benedict Lightwood's face. "That's a demon," Tessa breathed, forgetting for a moment to be Jessamine. "Isn't it?" Fortunately, Nate seemed to find nothing odd about the question. "Of course it is, silly bunny. That's what Benedict fancies. Demon women." Will's voice echoed in Tessa's ears. "I would be surprised if some of the elder Lightwood's nocturnal visits to certain houses in Shadwell haven't left him with a nasty case of demon pox."
"Oh, ugh,"
she said.
"Indeed," said Nate. "Ironic, considering the high and mighty manner in which the Nephilim conduct themselves. I ask myself often why Mortmain favors him so, and wishes to see him installed in the Institute so badly."
Nate sounded peevish. Tessa had already guessed as much, but the knowledge that Mortmain was most assuredly behind Benedict's fierce determination to take the Institute from Charlotte still felt like a blow.
"I just don't see,"
she said, trying her best to adopt Jessie's slightly peevish demeanor.
"What use it will be to the Magister? It's just a big, stuffy old building."
Nate laughed indulgently. "It's not the building, silly thing. It's the position. The head of the London Institute is one of the most powerful shadow hunters in England, and the Magister controls Benedict as if he were a puppet. Using him, he can destroy the Council from within, while the Automaton army destroys them from without." He spun her expertly as the dance required. Only Tessa's years of practice dancing with Nate kept her from falling over, so distracted was she by shock. "Besides, it's not quite true that the Institute contains nothing of value. Access to the Great Library alone will be invaluable for the Magister, not to mention the weapons room."
"And Tessa?"
She clamped down on her voice so it wouldn't tremble.
"Tessa?"
"Your sister. The Magister still wants her, doesn't he?"
For the first time, Nate looked at her with a puzzled surprise.
"We've been over this, Jessamine," he said. "Tessa will be arrested for illegal possession of articles of dark magic and sent to the Silent City. Benedict will bring her forth from there and deliver her to the Magister. It is all part of whatever bargain they've struck, though what Benedict is getting from it is not clear to me yet. It must be something quite significant, or he would not be so willing to turn on his own."
"Arrested? Possession of articles of dark magic?" Tessa's head spun. Nate's hand slipped around the back of her neck. He was wearing gloves, but Tessa couldn't rid herself of the feeling that something slimy was touching her skin.
"My little Jessie," he murmured. "You behave almost as if you've forgotten your own part in this. You did hide the Book of the White in my sister's room, as we asked you to, did you not?"
Of course I did. I was only joking, Nate."
"That's my good girl." He was leaning closer. He was definitely going to kiss her. It was most improper, but then nothing about this place would be considered proper. In a state of absolute horror, Tessa sputtered,
Nate! I feel dizzy, as if I might faint. I think it's the heat. If you could fetch me a lemonade.
He looked down at her for a moment, his mouth tight with bottled annoyance. But Tessa knew he could not refuse. No gentleman would. He straightened up, brushed off his cuffs, and smiled. Of course, he said with a bow. Let me help you to a seat first. She protested, but his hand was already on her elbow, guiding her toward one of the chairs lined up along the walls. He settled her into it and vanished into the crowd. She watched him go, trembling all over. Dark magic. She felt sick and angry. She wanted to slap her brother, shake him till he told her the rest of the truth, but she knew she couldn't.
"You must be Tessa Gray," said a soft voice at her elbow. "You look just like your mother."
Tessa nearly jumped out of her skin. At her side stood a tall, slender woman with long, unbound hair, the color of lavender petals. Her skin was a pale blue, her dress a long and floating confection of gossamer and tulle. Her feet were bare, and in between her toes were thin webs, like a spider's, a darker blue than her skin. Tessa's hands went to her face in sudden horror. Was she losing her disguise? But the blue woman laughed.
"I didn't mean to make you fearful of your illusion, little one. It is still in place. It is just that my kind can see through it. All this."
She gestured vaguely at Tessa's blonde hair, her white dress and pearls.
"Is like the vapor of a cloud, and you the sky beyond it. Did you know your mother had eyes just like yours? Gray sometimes, and blue at others?"
Tessa found her voice.
"Who are you?"
"Oh, my kind doesn't like to give our names. But you can call me whatever you like. You can invent a lovely name for me. Your mother used to call me Hyacinth."
"The blue flower," Tessa said faintly.
"How did you know my mother? You don't look any older than me." "After our youth, my kind does not age or die. Nor will you, lucky girl. I hope you appreciate the service done you."
Tessa shook her head in bewilderment.
"Service? What service? Are you speaking of Mortmain? Do you know what I am?" "Do you know what I am?"
Tessa thought of the Codex.
"A fairy?"
she guessed.
"And do you know what a changeling is?"
Tessa shook her head.
"Sometimes," Hyacinth confided, dropping her voice to a whisper, "when our fairy blood has grown weak and thin, we will find our way into a human home and take the best, the prettiest, and the plumpest child. And, quick as a wink, replace the babe with a sickly one of our own. While the human child grows tall and strong in our lands, the human family will find itself burdened with a dying creature, fearful of cold iron. Our bloodline is strengthened."
"Why bother?" Tessa demanded. "Why not just steal the human child and leave nothing in its place?" Hyacinth's dark blue eyes widened.
"Why, because that would not be fair," she said. "And it would breed suspicion among the mundanes. They are stupid, but there are many of them. It does not do to rouse their ire. That is when they come with iron and torches."
She shuddered. "Just a moment," Tessa said. "Are you telling me I'm a changeling?" Hyacinth bubbled over with giggles.
"Of course not. What a ridiculous thought."
She held her hands to her heart as she laughed, and Tessa saw that her fingers, too, were bound together with blue webbing. Suddenly she smiled, showing glittering teeth.
"There's a very good-looking boy staring over here," she said. "As handsome as a fairy lord. I should leave you to your business."
She winked, and before Tessa could protest, Hyacinth melted back into the crowd. Shaken, Tessa turned, expecting the good-looking boy to be Nate, but it was Will, leaning against the wall beside her. The moment her eyes found him, he turned and began studiously examining the dance floor.
What did that fairy woman want?
I don't know, Tessa said, exasperated. To tell me I'm not a changeling, apparently.
Well, that's good. Process of elimination.
Tessa had to admit, Will was doing a good job of somehow blending in with the dark curtains behind him, as if he were not there at all. Must have been a shadow hunter talent.
And what news from your brother?
She gripped her hands together, looking at the floor while she spoke. Jessamine's been spying for Nate all this time. I don't know how long, exactly. She's been telling him everything. She thinks he's in love with her. Will looked unsurprised.
Do you think he's in love with her?
I think Nate cares only about himself, said Tessa. There's worse, too. Benedict Lightwood is working for Mortmaine. That is why he is scheming to get the Institute, so the Magister can have it, and have me. Nate knows all about it, of course. He doesn't care. Tessa looked at her hands again. Jessamine's hands, small and delicate in their fine white kid gloves. Oh, Nate, she thought. Aunt Harriet used to call him her blue-eyed boy.
I expect that was before he killed her, said Will.
Only then did Tessa realize she had spoken aloud. And there he is again, he added in a mutter under his breath. Tessa glanced out at the crowd and saw Nate, his fair hair like a beacon, coming toward her. In his hand was a glass of sparkling golden liquid. She turned to tell Will to hurry